I am Sunita Mukherjee. I am the director of Asian American programs at the Charles B. Wong Center at Stony Brook University. So you have to appreciate the fact that I took 2.5 hours to get here. But it's a very important panel. I respect our artists here today. And I'm very excited to share with you their contributions to how Asian American women are represented in the work that they do, and even in how they themselves represent the Asian American women. As you can see, this panel is comprised of very young women. Who are very active actually in the culture field in various ways. We start with Jayashree Abhichandani, who is the founder of the South Asian Women's Creative Collective. That's how I came to know her first, but she's actually a brilliant conceptual artist also. So you have a combination of artistic activism as well as being an artist. We have also Vicky Ahn, who's actually quite sporting. She just stepped in yesterday. Michelle Yu, who was originally supposed to be with us today, had to do a last-minute shoot up in Yankee Stadium. And so Vicky Ahn came and said, yes, I want to do it. She is a young journalist for Time Incorporated for the kids. Time for Kids magazine, and she's, you know, fresh out of journalism school, so you have a very young perspective, and now she's part of the real world. And then I have also had the pleasure of dancing with Paz, who is of Filipino origin, and I am close to that aspect because though I look Indian, I am. But I was born and bred in the Philippines, and when I found a Filipina American who danced, I said, we need to have her in the panel. She's also the co-founder of Topaz Arts, where the dance collaborations and a venue for dance artists. So we have this group of people here who will be speaking to you and sharing insights. Some of them are going to be showing aspects of their work, so you can see how this dynamic Asian American woman is produced, represented, recreated, transformed in this space. So let's begin with Jayashree. I mean, I have a few questions that I wanted to ask them. And we will do it quite informally, and they will come and speak and, you know, contribute. And one of the questions that I want to really pose is really, as Vishakha had laid the groundwork for it, this whole idea of being a woman and being Asian American. How does that enrich, complicate the work that you people do, that we do? How does it affect, influence? Ladies, begin.
I think that everything I do is informed by my identity, what I do in terms of artwork or cultural production or exhibition. I wouldn't know where I have to work from or want to work.
In particular, in Filipino culture, female roles are very strong roles, like family roles, politically equal roles. But when it gets to the home, the artist is a double edge. And dance in particular is a female dominated art, Western culture. It's more female industry, but it is, there's the competition that's being dominated by white male.
In the Western world, yes.
And what we do, what I do, is the culture.
Most of the journalists you see are on television. You don't really get to see see or hear the print journalists. Very awesome. So in that way, I have a lot to prove in the field and at my IBM. I just want to show that Chinese American, Asian American can do more than just math and science and all that. I want to show that, you know, we're creative, we can write, we can do pretty much anything.
I also was very particular when I tried to put this panel together that we have. Though we may identify as Asian American, I wanted to make sure that this panel had the representations of ethnic particularities were obvious. So, for example, I did not really want all of these to be a particular kind of ethnicity. Because sometimes it's easy, you know, I'm of Indian origin, I could have gotten a number of artists of Indian origin to be here. But I wanted to be sure that we had a representation from Southeast Asia, India, South Asia, and of course East Asia. And of course all of them share the fact that they are in the United States doing their cultural work. Because as was mentioned also earlier in the keynote addresses today, that being of Asian origin, there's always this the stereotyping that the Asian is only the East Asian, when in fact Asia is quite diverse, and people of Asian American, people who are Asian American come from various ancestries and heritages. So we have these groups here. And already Paz mentioned something about her Filipino culture influencing her representation of being, her representation in her dance. Jayashree talked about her identity influencing her work. There is no other starting point. And the stereotype of the nerdy East Asian, she's trying to disprove. What I'd like to know is, what are the kinds of things that you do, the work that you do? Can you show us examples so that we can see this manifest in three dimensions, at least, two dimensions?
You know, I'm going to show a really fast little video, which is called Happily Never After.
Happily Never After, okay.
Yeah, and I think that it speaks a lot to what you just said and what Paz mentioned. As I said, it's a very brief 2.5 minute video, and there's a robot that you'll see, and the robot offers you various choices. And all of the choices are based on legends of Indian women saints who had actually lived. So whilst they're being offered to you as a choice that you can accept or refuse, they also actually represent a feminist poet that lived maybe 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago.
If you were God, when you were first loved, you would marry a young mortal, then gain your back, by becoming a prostitute, then consider all your lovers as gods in mortal forms. Shores too. If you were God, then your first lover, you would marry no mortal, but attain your God, becoming unmarriageable by transforming yourself either to a man, an old woman, or offering a lily in sacrifice. Shores three. If you were God, then your first lover, you would marry no mortal, but attain your God, by forever walking naked through the streets until you disappear or become a skeleton. Choice form. If your God is your first lover, you would marry no mortal, refusing even body human form. Or if you are forced to marry a mortal, you will make love to your husband only when you are deceived into believing him to be your God. Choice 5. If your God is your first lover, and you are forced to marry a mortal, you will get rid of him by walking out on him or terrifying him. When he dies, you will refuse the state of widowhood. Choice 6. If your God is your first lover, and you are forced to marry a mortal, you will bear him no children,
and synchronize your son in previous life. Show us seven. If your God is your first lover, and you are forced to marry a mortal and bear him children, you will regret them and see them as husbands from past lives.
So that's an example of some video work that addresses some of the issues that Baz mentioned, because I was very interested in looking at these choices that are offered to us to achieve perfect womanhood and or to achieve spiritual enlightenment, and what do those choices actually mean, and what are the repercussions of them for our lives. So that's, you know, just one piece, but there are a lot of other pieces that I'm going to, maybe I can just kind of present now. For example, first within my personal work, and then with what I do with the South Asian Women's Creative Collective. So this is a painting collage called The Rape Boss. It's a small piece. It's based on an old art historical painting called The Rape of the Sabine Woman. And what I was doing is taking the female figure from that, one of the old versions of that painting from the 16th century, and recontextualizing it in the framework of Iraq and what's happening there to women who are basically being violated by coalition forces and Iraqi armies as well. This is a piece called Last Woman Standing, and I'm wondering if we can get this light off, because there's just no way that you can see the work with the light shining onto the screen.
Is that possible? Is there a dimmer?
Behind you? Is that a dimmer there? But this is a painting of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's the last woman left on the Supreme Court, and I'm thinking about the position that she holds at this point. This is a painting.
And these are your work.
These are my work.
And you've exhibited this recently.
This is actually, this one is on view right now in Chelsea at a show called Firewalkers. As is this one, which is a painting of Comedies Arise. And this one is called Manifesting Destiny. And I'm thinking of her as the embodiment of the United States of America. So you see her with the wings of the American eagle, and you see her with the serpent's tail that she's devouring, and as well as spewing these serpents out of her mouth. And I'm thinking very much about how she's a very self-destructive and violent icon that represents America in this way to the world, basically, which is how we're being seen. This image is from a series that I did, which are fusing images of female American soldiers and female Palestinian suicide bombers. So what you're seeing here is a face that's been generated by putting together two women's faces. And you'll see me revisit this particular image in animation video form as well. This is another example of the same series, where I'm taking an image of an American soldier and transfusing it with a Palestinian suicide bomber. This is a painting that's called Superstar, and these are five women heads of state from South Asia. We have Aang from Burma, who's incarcerated, Sheikh Hasina from Bangladesh, who's incarcerated, Indira Gandhi and Benazir Bhutto, who've been assassinated, and Jeeva Singha from Sri Lanka, who's deposed. And they're all daughters of political scions, and they ascended to power through their familial connection. And I'm thinking very much about Hillary and how her precedent are these women. And, you know, sure, we can be really happy about having a woman in power, but that doesn't guarantee the woman's honesty or authenticity.
So it doesn't mean that just because you're a woman, you should be president.
Yeah. Did I just say that? Yeah. This last painting is called Butterfly, and it is a painting that combines the newly trained four Pakistani female fighter pilots and Iranian police women. And so the little figures that you see here are actually images of burqa-clad Iranian police women rappelling down buildings from a YouTube video. So that's kind of, in terms of my personal work.
Could you tell us what that made of?
It's painted with acrylic on canvas with jewels and thread that's sewn into it, and plastic flowers and feathers. And, you know, I use the paintings very much in sculptural pieces as well. So this, very briefly, is the South Asian Women's Creative Collective, which is an organization that I founded 11 years ago. Our mission, we have three chapters, one in New York, one in London, and one in San Francisco. The New York chapter is the oldest one. We have about 1,100 women on our listserv. And the way we function, it's laid out in this chart here. We have a volunteer board of directors, and all of the women on the board of directors are responsible for the administration, the fundraising, publicity, programming. Everything is done by this volunteer board, and all decisions for the organization are made collectively by the board. Our programming, we have two-part programming, some programming that is restricted for South Asian women because we were founded with the mission of providing a space to nurture and grow women artists, South Asian women artists, and provide them with the space. So we have monthly meetings still for the last 11 years, which have been held at the Asian American Writers Workshop, which has been our home then our entire lives. These monthly meetings, they're for and by South Asian women only. So you have women who volunteer to present their work, and they can also dictate what type of feedback they would like to receive during the meetings from the attendees at the presentation. Then we have the listserv, which, as I mentioned, has 1,100 plus women. We have Brown Eyed Girls, which is a self-run writers group where women workshop each other's writing. We have a studio circle where women go to each other's studios, visual artists, practicing artists, and kind of give each other feedback and critique, but that's very much on a much more professional level because the dialogue in those studio circle meetings has to be very professionally geared. And then we have public events, and the public events include slide slams, poetry slams, experimental film and video evenings, visual arts exhibitions, literary festivals. Here's an image of some of the women from our 10th anniversary exhibition. You might have seen a book out there called Sultana's Dream, which was the name of our 10th anniversary exhibition last year. Sultana's Dream, we presented 22 collaborative art projects, all of which were made by Middle Eastern and South Asian women working with each other. So we had a huge range of works internationally, from women from Kuwait to Bangladesh to everything in between. We had videos, performance, sculpture, you name it, we had it. We had public programs to go with it, which included a film and video screening. It included a literary panel and visual arts panel. And recently, about 2-3 weeks ago, we had a slide slam where we presented the work to some women that had not been seen in the collective. So the way that we function is really to provide both an internal space for the growth of women's work and as a space outside where we can present the professional work within the larger kind of context of whatever it may be, whether it's a literary festival in talking about publishing and writing, or it's the visual arts, etc.
So I think it's the important thing to take note here is that there are sessions where it's exclusively just for women, women artists and women lovers of art, mm-hmm. art and artists, to come together to discuss these pieces of work so that they can flourish or develop. Mm-hmm. So Paz, tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, I'm a choreographer and dancer, as well as run Topaz Arts, which is a nonprofit arts organization that is founded by Todd Richmond, our partner and co-director at Topaz Arts. Topaz Arts supports our work, our collaborative work, which we have produced several dance works per year. And right now, I'm just going to briefly show you our last work that we did at Joyce Temple in New York. What we do is we collaborate on film as well as dance and music, and it's contemporary work that the issue that I'm dealing with right now is actually realizing what we're talking about. I'm basing the work on Yoko Ono's The Manuscript,
okay.
Which is she wrote it at a very young age, at 19, soon after the atomic bomb dropped on Japan, and it's a very abstract work, so I decided to investigate what that was, and actually took a trip to Japan this past January, February, to revisit the place, the country, and what I found was just there's always more questions than like to dig into issues. First of all, Yoko Ono is a very complicated character, person,
yeah.
People still equate her breaking up people, which, you know, she's first and foremost, in my mind, a woman artist who creates important work. And the issue is the nuclear weapons, testing is still going on, and that whole relationship with Japan, the Philippines, it was very complicated then, it still is now. And I'm equating these man-made disasters parallel to what happened in 9/11. What struck me with her story was that it was a realization within some of within yourself that the world is askew. So I played with the images she wrote in her text as well as some inspiration that I got from the title itself, which is called Soundless Music. So it's a very abstract work and still a work in progress. So we can still keep doing it.
Thank you.
performance, we worked with both film and dance. The first part was film version. Now the film.
Writing to adults, to writing for children was very challenging in that you have to really think about the sentence structure you use. You can't use anything too complex. You can't use complex vocabulary. And so it was quite a different move for me going from writing for adults to writing for children. And one of the things I focus on is showcasing children who have done amazing things. So I brought a few articles to hand out. I write for the back page, page 8, which is our entertainment page, and I also write on page 7, along with feature stories, and I write for the in the news page, 2-3 spread. If you look at the Uniting for Peace article that was just handed out, the PR person for the Just Peace Summit came to me and asked if we wanted to cover this, and basically the Just Peace Summit was a summit for key leaders from around the world who were making a difference in their communities. And so I thought, wow, this is a perfect piece for a Time for Kids. We can showcase all these kids. And looking at the 30 team leaders that were chosen for this conference, I really thought hard about who I wanted to showcase, and I specifically chose Asian Americans or Asian students, actually Asian Americans, because I wanted to focus on the U.S., who had made a difference in their community. So in that way, that's one of the ways that I try to highlight what Asian Americans are doing in this country. That's just one way. So Janet So, one of the students from the East Coast that attended the summit, She is spreading the word about slavery, modern slavery in the U.S. And I think that's a topic that's not covered very often. So, especially, you know, for adolescents, kids, I thought she would be great to showcase. Another young man named Dylan, he was trying to educate people about the Millennium Goals, the Millennium Development Goals. And so I think having these kids and showing what they're doing is very important to show other kids of Asian American descent that they can make a difference in their communities too. That's one way that I try to make a difference, being a journalist.
Because I would suspect if there was somebody else doing this, they may have not had that bit.
Exactly.
Yet.
Right. So that's just one way. And in the other article I handed out in the magazine, to show how I...
We don't need a counselor. We finished our presentation already. Yeah. Thank you.
On page 7 of this issue of the magazine, I discovered this girl who had been adopted as a baby from Peru. And had, you know, she went to visit with her mother when she was about 10 years old or something. She was really young. And at that point, she, once seeing the orphanage that was near her hometown where she was born, she realized that, you know, these kids need help. And she decided to start an organization to help these other children get everything they need. So that's another way. I don't just think about Asian Americans in general. I also think about other minority groups within the U.S. So that's another way that I try to make a difference in the field.
But also, is your demographic is different than
right.
Jayshree's and Fonz?
Yes, they're kids.
They're young people.
They're young people, yeah. Kids. We have one edition that's for second and third graders, another edition that's for sixth to fourth graders.
What do you define as kids? I mean, what's the age group?
Students. From second to third grade and fourth to sixth grade.
Second to third to fourth to sixth.
Yes, we have separate magazines that we have to tailor to each.
So 5 to 11 is the range.
Yes. And kids, you know, they're still moldable. They're still, you can still shape their minds. And to see young people like them going out and doing these things, it really sparks something in them. And we receive letters every day from kids who are like, oh, I read this article and now I really want to help. I really want to do something. Tell me how to help. And that's really rewarding.
So when you write your articles, you do add a socially conscious bent.
Yes.
So giving an opportunity for young people to find ways of changing the world.
Yes.
As such. It is very interesting. The work that you do and the work that Faz does and Jeshu, as I said, their audiences are different, the demographic that you serve are different. In the case of Faz's work, I feel, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the work is really contemporary dance. The theme is not, and the aesthetic is not necessarily quote-unquote Asian, to put in quotes. In the case of Jeshri, her work takes a lot of aesthetic, is influenced aesthetically with South Asia and Central Asia, or even West Asia. And her advocacy for the South Asian Women's Creative Collective, from the name itself, is South Asia. So there's a very strong ethnic particularity. In your case, the magazine is mainstream, but you're trying to add a little bit of, not a little bit, a lot of multicultural perspective. What I'd like to ask Paul actually is, how does your Filipino Americanness affect your work?
That's interesting. I'm thinking about that. Movement-wise, I've developed my own style, but innately I incorporated the aesthetics of Filipino dance, not in the direct link of our studying Filipino dance. My first piece actually went, I researched Filipino dance, traditional dance, and found ways that were innately in my body already. So it was interesting that the arms have become important to me, the use of my arms. And it's interesting that because I do this contemporary movement that's not directly linked to the teachings of traditional dance, but I really feel it's something that I've embodied into my movement, which some people, you know, someone once told me, I'd like to challenge you to not use your arms. I'm like, that's really strange because that's like the Western views of what dance, quote unquote, is to them, and it's like, you know, asking a ballerina not to use her feet, you know.
Or her toes, right?
Yeah, to use her toes. So to me, that just showed me the perception of what dance is for some people. And, you know, if you see a lot of arm movement, it's defined differently as what my aesthetic
what's your Filipino-ness in your dance? You've answered the question.
Yeah.
You have answered the question. And I guess even having Topaz Arts in Woodside,
yes,
which is a very strong Filipino population.
Yes.
But I don't know how Filipinos respond to your work.
Yeah, well, growing up in a family that does not really appreciate the arts, it, you know, I became an artist on my own. mother is a doctor, your father is a dancer. So it was a struggle to really find what it was that I was doing. Becoming an artist felt like a rebellion, but now it's a necessity. That, you know, that's why I became an artist. That's what I feel contributes most. So growing up in a family that really didn't see arts as important, which they do now, to finally get what I'm doing. it's hard, you know.
It's also, you know, it's, I mean, not to, I mean, it is difficult for any parent, whether Asian or not,
right,
immigrants, you know, to worry about what their young daughters are going to do when they grow up. And to even the choice of being an artist for any kind of thing is difficult. Being a mediocre artist is easy, but you know, the success comes when you're a great artist, when you're a good artist, or a commercial artist. You know, so it is already difficult to begin with. Plus, it's complicated by the fact that you are of Asian origin. You've come to America, we're supposed to be doing better. And the idea of a starving artist is anathema. What are you doing here? You could have been starving in your own country. Why are you coming to the States?
I was just recently in the Philippines and I gave a workshop and artist talk there in Manila, and a lot of people came and taught a dance workshop, and it was refreshing that, you know, all our struggles are the same.
as artists,
but you know, you do it because you need to.
And the same way that you also are pursuing, as you mentioned earlier, you're pursuing something that's unusual, you know. And would you like to tell us a little bit about how you came upon this and what were the responses of your near and dear ones?
Well, I learned early on that I wasn't very good at math.
She's ashamed.
To this day, when we eat out at restaurants, there's a big group. You know, we have to flip the bill, and I pass it on to the food. Because I can't do math to save my life. I've always been, you know, I started reading at a very young age, and I think that really sought out the writer in me. You know, I'd read, we'd go to the library every other day, and I'd check out, like, the brain we should read, and I'd finish them all in one day. So that's when I knew that I wanted to go into writing, I wanted to be creative. At first, I wanted to be an author, I wanted to write books. But
that can still happen, huh?
But starting out as an author is very hard. You have to be good. You have to be a good writer. You have to be a good author. And authors don't make that much money starting out if their books aren't bestsellers. I'll go into journalism. Steady job, steady paying job. I can do this. When I told my parents, they were pretty supportive, which I was surprised, but you know, there were still questions of my parents would still ask me, are you sure you don't want to go to grad school and be a lawyer? Are you sure you don't want to go to law school? I said no. I don't want to go to law school. But I was very surprised that they were supportive of what I wanted to do, and I graduated with a journalism degree from University of Texas at Austin. While I was there, when I first started, I thought I wanted to do entertainment reporting all the way. So it was even a surprise to me when I accepted the job at Time for Kids. Because I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never been into kids before. But
you see, even the things that you've talked about, the articles, mm-hmm. are not necessarily just entertainment.
Right. So I had to branch out and write about other things. And that's actually really helped my writing a lot. Learning about different topics, meeting new people. And I still do the entertainment thing too. So that's so fun. When I was in college, I was on the school newspaper, Daily Texan, and I also was editor-in-chief of a magazine called Asian Collections, which covered the Asian American community at the university, as well as in Austin and beyond nationwide. So that really helped shape in my mind that I wanted to highlight the Asian American community more in mainstream writing as well.
How has your journey been as an artist?
Well, it's been really interesting because when I started out, I was very much self-taught, living in Queens and documenting about Asian communities there. And then as time went on, I kind of found this Dossie and met all these amazingly well-educated young women with MFAs.
And articulate women, right?
Yes.
Argumentative and articulate.
Yes, absolutely. That were, you know, getting their MFAs and figuring out how to participate in the art world here, and I kind of learned along with them. And, you know, now I have this master's degree, and, you know, Sophie, I started a chapter of Sophie in London while I was studying and doing my master's there. But I think that it's been a really kind of interesting journey, and I was thinking about how things are somewhat different in the visual arts world, because some of you may know how much money there is in the Asian art market at this point. Mm-hmm. And what that really means is that Asian artists from Asia are becoming rather rich. It doesn't necessarily mean that Asian American artists are doing any better. In fact, what it means is that some of the Asian American artists who at one point were the highest paid stars are now making less than their Asian counterparts from Asia. And it's this very interesting dynamic that's developed, which further complicates our position and how we interact as Asian American artists, interact and negotiate with these spaces. In a way, it's really great to see that the art market is so open that it's now able to accommodate and embrace all these various ways of working together, working on a bit of work, whether it happens to be conceptual, political, photorealistic, whatever it may be. It seems to me like, you know, now the market will buy anything, which is a good thing, but, you know, it's also, what does that do to Asian American artists who are positioning themselves with a certain degree of criticality or trying to position themselves within institutions that become part of the dialogue that, theoretical dialogue, say, that is somewhat different from what's happening in the market. So, you know, in my own journey, going from someone who was a, you know, documentary photographer, like working class living in Queens, to someone who's a trained artist and, you know, regularly exhibiting in various formal spaces now, it's a continuous journey of learning and discovery, really. And having to constantly push yourself to itself and to stay relevant.
And also the struggle, you mentioned a number of them, the struggle of commerce, mm-hmm. and the struggle of really the definition of the Asian artists, mm-hmm. and where is the position then of the Asian American?
Yeah.
Is the Asian American Asian? Or a American, and how then that really complicates in a way your viability. I mean, how then do you show your work? Because to some extent, having this exotic difference, again in quotes, is helpful. When we have something else to bring on the table, a different voice, an unusual thing.
I have to say at this point, it's not enough to just do that.
Absolutely.
You have to, along with bringing that additional voice, really have that voice be completely individual and offering something that is very honestly, sincerely unique, or, you know, you're kind of producing by formula.
Actually, because stereotypical.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely, I totally agree. But then that becomes also another layer for your work. If this is, you're not just a Filipina American, you're also an artist. You're not just South Asian, you're also Jayashri, right? And you are also Vicky. You know, besides the fact that you know you are a journalist from Austin, Texas, and now you're in New York, you know, you have to deal with that. So it's like these are multiple identities that are enriching your work. Okay, so where do we go from here? What's the next step for Asian American women artists?
More funding.
More funding.
Seriously, because I think one of the biggest challenges we face is just finding that funding to realize our visions, and our visions are constantly stymied and cannot reach their full ambition because we don't have the resources, and people don't have the vision to provide those resources. Yes.
Also open funding too. I mean, the funding circle involves producers, you know, they often produce shows, like pages and shows. It's like, what does that mean?
Right.
Where they're expecting, you know, to be traditional social events. What if you don't see that?
That's right.
So you fall between the lines, mm-hmm. and some funding organizations, you know,
just heritage, things that are heritage-based, rather than.
It's difficult when you're dancing between the lines and not knowing where you fit in, but you know, you need that funding to figure it out.
That funding complication that you're talking about is also exacerbated by the fact that if, for Saucy, because we're a multidisciplinary presenting organization, arts organizations, say a visual arts organization, may not take us very seriously because we also present writers and filmmakers and musicians, and not just visual artists. So you get marginalized in that professional funding category. But then if you approach community or Asian American or whatever people of color funders, you know, there's always going to be someone who's like poorer than Saucy women, who they think deserves that money more. So every single time, you know, young teenagers' video or mural project will get funded every single time over what they consider young women who are college educated with degrees who happen to be in a different bracket and are not as fundable, you know, because we don't fulfill their ghetto stereotypical expectations. And that's why we get knocked out of those funding categories. Whereas exactly what you're saying, which is that, and what Baz is doing, which is presenting work, which is of a very particular, which has a very particular thing to offer to both communities, it's pushing boundaries in both professional and community spaces, that work itself doesn't get the type of support that it needs because it may not be deemed professional or artistic or, you know, ghetto enough, whatever it may be, you know.
But you see, the thing is that in the case of Vicky, it's a little different because time is mainstream. It's funded well, right? You know that. Funded well, this big media industry is funds this. From where you were 10 years ago, Saucy and Topaz Arts is known. It may not be known in the mainstream world because your work is not mainstream.
No.
You're not in the popular culture world. Already there is a niche for you. Okay, there's a particular place. But compared to what you were 10 years ago when you began, you have space. You did Sultana's art. You're presenting in various mainstream museums already. So there's enough hope that there are people who are enlightened enough or have an understanding, and maybe some of these people gave up their careers as engineers and doctors and started giving attention to art and the critical and activist use of art in there to fund that. And I think that there is some hope in that. We have a few minutes actually. I wanted actually to open the discussion to our audience. If you had any questions to ask any of us. Yes.
This is a question that the lady on the right.
Vicky is her name?
Vicky, sorry. Vicky, has your organization considered becoming more interactive, or is print still the way that you guys go forward?
You mean running to the internet?
The internet and perhaps TV or some form of television, because that's also migrating to the internet.
Right.
But I mean, kids seem to learn a lot faster or get informed a lot better when they can interact.
We are improving our website. We do have a website, timeforkids.com, and we cover a lot of content. We have games on the site. We update news stories every other day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And we also have special mini sites where kids, they also do, during the summers we work on issues called Around the World, where we cover a variety of countries throughout the world, including Asian countries, and we have many sites for those, for kids to learn about these countries, learn about everything that's going on in other places. So we have branched out to the internet. I think we've had a website since 1998. And also teachers can get a lot of help materials there too. We provide comprehension quizzes for the web stories as well as for the magazine worksheets that they can work off of. We haven't thought about branching out to TV. I don't think that's something we're considering right now.
How does the print circulation compare with your website? Things of the hits.
I'm not sure how many hits we get. I hope it's a lot. But our circulation, we go out primarily to schools. I believe our circulation is about 3 million subscribers throughout the U.S.
Yes. But in fact, the internet can also be very helpful to non-mainstream artists, because your work can be shown virally globally. And in fact, the way I understand SOCI, South Asian Women's Creative Collective, the listserv, which I'm very proud to be part of, you get to know what's happening all over the world with artists from London and parts of Asia that never knew existed, talking to each other about the kind of work that they do, and also if they needed a futon or if they needed a place to stay when they visit Toronto, out of the blue. So it's really quite an amazing, because of what the internet, the tentacles of the internet, go everywhere. So that's one way also of getting your artwork out there. Questions from our esteemed audience.
Yeah, you were saying if they go to the teacher's site, or what is there in teacher's site?
Oh, on the Time for Kids teacher's site, there are comprehension quizzes, and there are different worksheets that teachers can use to that accompany the stories that we cover in the magazine. There's news stories, pretty much everything a teacher could need is on that site. We're trying to do more, actually. We're trying to... Claudia, can you help me out? That's my goal.
What exactly did you want to find out as a teacher? Because actually I'm a teacher.
Or you are?
I'm teaching here actually my language, Hindi, in Ali, for the adults also and for the small people. I know a lot of teaching material for the languages and prepare the things. That's why I was thinking.
Well, when you go to the teacher site, there's a lot of information about how you can get teacher-created materials, because we work with teachers.
A lot of materials, small stories, and teaching materials. And
that's just one place to start. If you go to timeforkids.com, that's the teacher site, and you'll find all the information you need. There's we have something called teacher-created materials, which we worked with specifically with teachers, and they came up with different workbooks and stuff that we distribute to different schools around the country. You can work, you can get that. You can also find quizzes, like what you just said. But it's all about how we incorporate the magazine into classrooms. Mm-hmm. We try to get the curriculum, try to write stories based on the curriculum, etc. But you can basically just, whatever subject you're working on, you can find a quiz or some kind of activity that you can use with your students on the website. And there's also a teacher's guide that comes with this every week that, you know, it explains what the cover story is about, it gives you questions and how to explain it to the kids. We can give you our information if you want.
I'm
going to
talk more about this. Well, she's been there for like 7 years.
What inspired you to become a dancer? What inspired you to get into that field?
Well, it's interesting. I actually started out as a visual artist, which I did in my undergrad at the University of California, San Diego. And it was there that I took dance classes and things like that, not seriously, but after studying visual art, I found that dance became my form to explore my ideas. So that it kind of evolved first in visual art, and then finding ways. I ended up dancing in my painting studio more than painting something. So then I went to NYU Tisch School of the Arts to get my master's in dance. It just evolved from starting to work with choreographers and then eventually choreographing on my own and different companies. So it was an evolution of first becoming an artist, then a dancer.
And do you still dance?
Yes.
You still paint, is really what I wanted to
ask. Actually, I draw and paint, and I feel like it's still integrated, where the ideas really come from visual arts ideas more, and then it transfers to dance.
Yes.
I know we're running out of time. This is kind of a big question. I mean, we've been kind of skirting around it throughout the entire discussion, but do you three see, as being in the arts yourselves, do you see us moving towards sort of a unique Asian American culture that we can sort of say is unique and distinctive, and is our, are we moving towards that? And if we are, do you see that as a good thing or perhaps a bad thing in terms of, you know, for any sort of reason, like funding reasons or, you know, whatever? And do you see that, or, you know, or do you not see that? And if you do, good or bad? I guess just
very interesting.
Because I do. I truly believe so. And I think that Asian American women are actually leading the way with that, actually. But I wanted to hear your opinion. Anything, anyone.
I would really hesitate to desire one monolithic Asian American. You know, I'm all for, you know, building alliances, working in solidarity, and defining myself as Asian American whenever need be and whenever it's necessary. But I wouldn't want to impose any, you know, singular idea of what that would mean. And I think that even in probably who we are sitting here today, our experiences are so completely different. I grew up in a small town in India for most of my life until I came here. So it's really difficult to want to even erase those differences.
Well, not necessarily to erase them, but just as the Desi culture has sort of emerged from the different South
yeah.
Asian communities that have
yeah.
built it. I mean, South Asia itself is whole dozens of countries.
Mm-hmm.
But and yet there's Desi culture here in the United States and in England and all over the place. But I mean, you know, do we see something like that for the larger Asian American community?
I think part of an one identity.
Mm-hmm.
it's becoming more of an awareness that all these different groups that are becoming stronger and stronger, Arts Alliance, and you know, and it's the encouragement of being part of a group, and then those groups talk to each other. I think that you know everyone's so different from each other, and our work so different from each other. But the awareness that you know that that we exist is becoming larger, and I think it's really encouraging.
It's also a sense of having affiliation to multiple communities.
Yeah.
Having, you know, being part of a broad umbrella Asian American community, but even that in itself is diverse because running a cultural center out in Stony Brook University, which I do, and having to deal with a group of faculty who think of Asia America as the Asian American movement that happened in the 60s and 70s, and that is the Asian American consciousness. And dealing with young students who come from Queens as children of immigrants who are thinking of another kind of Asian America, and then dealing with people like myself who come from a diasporic Asia, you know, born in the Philippines, of Indian heritage, now in New York, and having affiliations globally. So you have these multiple Asian-nesses to deal with, you know.
It's also changed, I think, a lot, frankly, for the South Asian community since post-9/11, and not just South Asian Americans, but also Arab Americans. And say, like, to speak organizationally within SAUSI when initially, 11 years ago, we were much more integrated into the Asian American scene, which was really largely defined as Chinese and Korean, with a smattering of, you know, Indian and Japanese thrown in, you know. But that identity focus and alliances that we built earlier has definitely shifted, where there's so many more alliances we build now with Middle Eastern, Arab, Muslim populations. And, you know, those, what's happened externally has so much impacted internally this section of the Asian American community and how they're interacting with each other. So as I mentioned, last year's SAUSI show, we had, you know, South Asian and Middle Eastern women, and that's been since September 11th, that's been kind of a consistent thing that we have done over and over and over, which is that, you know, there's always been space for the Muslim women in the collective, but now we're trying to really give them so much more of a visible public face within the organization.
So, in answer to your question, yes and no. Yes. I mean, it's like because the Asian American culture is so dynamic and diverse that we may even say something now, but the generation that comes after us, the group of people she answers to will redefine it and say that, you know, well, yeah, I am American, but you know, but you, who knows what they're going to even answer, because it's really quite an evolution. Should we have alliances? But always thinking that there are really distinct differences between Asians and Asian American experiences. Grandparents, our parents, children, our cousins, our siblings who are 5-6 years younger than us, they're experiencing their Asianness in an entirely different way.
To what extent do you think in the future the individual countries, as it were, communities from individual countries in Asia, because these are ancient societies, to what extent will they break out of this Asian American sort of catch-all and become separate defined communities? Like there are, for example, there's Mexican Americans and Puerto Rican Americans, not just Spanish people, Hispanic people, although there is an effort to lump them as one. Is there? Do you see that happening? I mean,
but it is happening already.
It's going on concurrently. Obviously, it's always been there.
I mean, there is the Latino.
The question is to what extent
the Latino, the La Raza, You have the, you know, the Latino, Latino people speaking as one, but you also have Puerto Ricans who are different than the Mexicans.
Well, every time I go to a Hispanic event, media event, the first thing I hear is people on the podium complaining that, you know, the mainstream audience don't realize that there are 26 different Hispanic communities who all have variations in their Spanish.
You complain about that too.
So, you know,
but I mean,
just wondering where that echoes here.
It's so complex, right?
Yeah, I mean, I say it's kind of like, you know, the Jackson Heights Merchants Association at one point was the only South Asian Merchants Association in Jackson Heights. And then you have now the Pakistani Merchants Association, the Bangladesh Merchants Association, all in that three-block radius, right? But tell me, we can do these Asian American conferences, but is the Korean Grocers Association ever going to get together with those merchants associations?
That's my question.
I don't think so, frankly.
Right.
But you see, but it's also a different context, it's a different community. We also answer, as a group here, we also answer to an intellectual, academic, artistic community. That's also our community, which is flavored with Asian American consciousness. Jayashree goes to South Asian Women's Creative Collective, which is South Asian, as you can hear. She goes to her dance community, which may not have anything to do with.
But we also work together.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Different capacity.
But you see, we are affiliated, and not just we, you, we all are affiliated to various communities, and it is really very contextual. What becomes problematic is when these differences become wedges. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is a wedge. I can't be with you, dancer. I'm theater person, okay? I can't.
I mean, yeah. I mean, look at the media. Like, I'm hopeful that Asian American identity is changing in mainstream media. The Yamaguchi boy and Dancing with the Stars. And, you know. It sounds, you know, one thing, but there's a million people watching those shows. All of a sudden, you know, that breaks a barrier where, you know, people are sitting in their living room watching the presentation and they're just a woman dancing. And they get to know her, and they get to know her as a person, an American. So, you know, the stereotypes are breaking down.
Anything to say, Vicky?
I agree with
that. Anyway, I think is our time over? Should we go out to recept?
We're set up to 3:30.
Okay, we should go then. Thank you so much for your contribution.